Well, thank you very much. That was just absolutely lovely. Really appreciate that. I don't know about you, but I think this M&M sounds a whole lot better than the other M&M, who makes a whole lot more money than these two ladies do. So really appreciate their efforts there. That was just gorgeous. Although it made me think, when are we going to get to hear the A and B duo? Arthur and Bruce. So. Never is that the, okay? All right. Well, I'd rather hear the M&M duo. So, anyway, but yeah, I really appreciate that. What a beautiful, beautiful Sabbath day. Good to see all of you here today. So, today we will be. Let me say up front. I apologize. This is going to go a bit longer than usual. This is there's not a good stopping place, frankly, in here. So I'm going to rip through this as quickly as I can. It will go faster if we don't have what happened in Denver this morning, which is a certain redhead who will not be named, who's heckling me, saying, speed up, speed up, speed up. So let's hope that doesn't happen, which will only delay us a little bit more. But today we'll be continuing with our study of the Gospels here. Last time we spent quite a bit of time going through Jesus meeting with Nicodemus there in Jerusalem at the first Passover of his ministry, when Jesus told him that he had to be born again. And we went through what that terminology means, what it means to be born again. And then spent quite a bit of time on John 3:16, one of the most well-known verses of the Bible. So we'll continue the story today. This will be in page 14 of the Harmony, on the about middle of the page here, beginning with John 3 and verse 22. And by the way, Brian, great to see you. Man, I didn't recognize you, but man, it's been a long time, so great to see you. Glad to have you here with us today. So, yeah, really outgrown, grown a lot since last time I saw you, so great to see you here. So, pick up the story here in John 3 and verse 22. After these things, Jesus and his disciples, I guess I better project it up here on screen for you. After these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea, and there he remained with them and baptized. Now John, talking about John the baptizer, also was baptizing in Aenon near Salim, because there was much water there, and they came and were baptized. For John had not yet been thrown into prison. And as we've mentioned before, this location, Aenon near Salim, is what I called an Elijah place. We've discussed before how John, being the second Elijah, or the Elijah who is to come to prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah, is doing conscious things to make people think of the original Elijah. So the places where he sees where we see in the Gospels that he's baptizing are significant places from the ministry of the original Elijah. This Aenon near Salim is very near the place where Elijah, if you remember the story, there was the drought in Israel, and he was staying by a brook and being fed by the ravens. This is very near this particular place. As we talked about in previous studies, where John is baptizing and where he baptizes Jesus is within about a half a mile of the spot where Elijah was taken up into the sky by a fiery chariot. So John the baptizer is making a conscious choice where he is working, where he is baptizing, to remind people of the original Elijah, who was a forerunner of John to come. We'll go through and cover that ground again, but you can see that in the earlier studies on the ministry of John if you're interested in learning more about that. So let's take a look at where this is on the map. This Aenon near Salim is in the Jordan River Valley. Here's Jerusalem over here, the Dead Sea, the Jordan River running down from the north. And up here is the location of this, very near, well, actually at the Jordan River there. And it also notes here, John, the Apostle John, writing this, mentions that he's baptizing here because there was much water here. And this tells us something about the proper method of baptism. Because if baptism is done by sprinkling, you know, a few drops of water, or pouring a cup of water, all you need is a cup of water. You don't need much water. So just the fact that if you're going to baptize someone by immersion, and baptize in the Greek means to submerge, other writings of the time talk about ships and naval battles being baptized, meaning they were sunk They went to the bottom of the sea. They were immersed completely in water. So that's what the meaning of the word baptize means. And you need much water to fully immerse someone. So this is just a brief mention in passing, but it does show us what the proper method of baptism is. And it had to be done by immersion. Otherwise, this mention here makes no sense. So continuing, verse 25 down here at the bottom. Then there arose a dispute between some of John's disciples, John the Baptizer, and the Jews about purification. I won't spend a lot of time on this. We will see in the future purification arising as an issue between Jesus Christ and some of the other religious people of his day. And we touch on that a little bit in discussing the wedding at Cana, where Jesus turns about 150 gallons of water into wine. And where did the water come from? It was in purification vessels, stone purification vessels that were used for ritual washing of the hands and so on by the Jews there at this period. Later on, we'll see disputes between Jesus and his disciples over these same issues that we don't have time to go into. At this point, a couple of scriptures you might write down relating to this. John 2 and verse 6 is about the ritual vessels at the wedding in Cana. And then also Mark 7 verses 1 through 13, where Jesus really gets into it with the other Jews there about them being so concerned with the ritual washing and that sort of thing that they're overlooking and actually disobeying some of God's commandments. Because their rituals there, putting more emphasis on that. So, again, we'll cover that when we get to it in the future. Just wanted to insert this as a note that this is going to be a source of contention. We'll also talk a little bit about where this comes from if we have time later on today. So, continuing the story, verse 26. And they, meaning John's disciples, came to John and said to him, Rabbi, again, we see John the Baptizer is a rabbi. There, as we've discussed before, Rabbi, who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him. And this is, of course, referring to Jesus Christ. John answered, verse 27, and said, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. And we see synonyms like this used a lot of times in the Gospels. The Jews of that day would not use God's name, or they would not say God. They would use a synonym like heaven, or the powers, or on high, or something like that. But actually, the way we would read it, the way we would describe that, is a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from God. They're using heaven as a synonym for God there. So, verse 28, you yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. And that's, you can write down in your notes, John 1, verses 20 through 23. There, incidentally, I'll just give you a few scriptures to refer to as I'm going through the study. Otherwise, we'd be doing, there's so many scriptural references to cover. I'm just going to hit the most important ones here like this. Otherwise, we'd be doing this for the next 20 years. I was telling somebody in Denver this morning, yeah, we're all the way up to page 14. We're 10% of the way there after a year or so. Anyway, that's how much progress we're making. But continuing on then, verse 29, John says, he who has the bride is the bridegroom. But the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease. So what's going on here? Let's just cut to the chase, see what's happening here. Basically, some of John's disciples are coming to John, and they're concerned because now Jesus has his own disciples, not all of them. There's only five of them at this point, and they are also baptizing. And as we saw earlier, several lessons ago, that some of John's own disciples have left John to follow Jesus, including John, the Apostle John, the one who is writing what we're reading here today. So if you are a disciple of a rabbi, as John's disciples are, you're not going to want to see this. You're not going to want to see your fellow disciples leave your rabbi to follow another rabbi, because after all, the fact you are a disciple means that you're following your rabbi because you think he's the best rabbi. He's the best teacher. So it's kind of discouraging to see other rabbis having more success, as Jesus is having at this point. So you don't want to see other people flocking away from your rabbi and going to a different rabbi, as with Jesus. Now, John, the baptizer, could have been upset by this, could have had his feelings hurt by this, because after all, he knows he is a teacher chosen by God for a specific mission there, specific purpose. But that is not John. That is not his attitude. He has a wonderful attitude, the kind of attitude that we all ought to have. What does John tell his disciples? He tells them basically that he never expected anything different from this. He says, he, Jesus, must increase and I must decrease. I'm not the important one here. Jesus is. John knew that he is to be the herald. He is to be the messenger, the one coming with an announcement that somebody greater than he is coming. That is essentially what John is telling his disciples here. He knew that he is to be the subordinate one. And he knows also that if people are flocking to Jesus rather than him, it's because God is sending people to Jesus. Not that Jesus is taking people away from him. And that's essentially what it means in verse 27, where John says, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven or from God. He's saying God is sending people to Jesus. Jesus isn't stealing people from me. So he knows what is important. He has a very humble, serving attitude as a result of that. So John realizes he doesn't have anything to complain about. This is God's doing. This is the way it was planned. This is the way it was intended, the way it was designed. And then John uses the metaphor of the bridegroom and what we today would call the best man. They didn't use that term, best man, in that culture, but it illustrates the point that Jesus is the bridegroom. He's the important one. The best man is not the important one. The bridegroom is the important one. And that's the point that he's making there. That he is just happy to be the best man, the friend of the bridegroom there, because the bridegroom is the important one. So again, he's focusing people not on himself, but on Jesus Christ as well. And that frankly, is why we're doing this series of studies on the Gospels. So I'm trying to do the same thing John is doing, which is to focus us on Jesus Christ and on God the Father. That's the way he saw his mission. That's my mission. That's my job, to point us to Jesus Christ and to God the Father. And now we come to an interesting section that, reading in the New King James Version, it has quotation marks, which would indicate this is John continuing to talk. And one of the study questions I sent out for you last night is to read through this section and see whose words do you think these are. As I mentioned last time, in the original Greek and Hebrew, there's no punctuation. There's no periods, no question marks, no exclamation points. There's not even a spot where you can say definitively this is where a sentence begins and ends. So punctuation was added much later in the process here. So as a result of that, translators kind of have to interpret as to when somebody is speaking, when another person is speaking, which is the author's words and which is the words that he's quoting here. Just as an FYI, I checked about 15 different translations in looking into this, and about a third of those had quotation marks like we see in the New King James, as though these are the words of John the Baptizer. About a third of them have no quotation marks, indicating it's the words of John the Apostle. And another third have no quotation marks, period, following the pattern of the original Greek. So they're not taking a position one way or the other on where a quote begins and ends and so on. So I mentioned that just to help you realize there are differences of opinion. So let's look at these words now and see whose words these most likely are. So verse 31, well, let's read verse 30 again, where John the Baptizer says, he must increase, but I must decrease. And then we get into this next chain of thought here. He who comes from above is above all. He who is of the earth, in contrast to from above, is earthly and speaks of the earth. He who comes from heaven or from God is above all. And what he has seen and heard, that he testifies, and no one receives his testimony. So the point that's being made here is that Jesus is above all because he came from God. And thus he is far greater than anybody who is just of the earth, just a physical human being, as any of us are. And what he has seen and heard, that he testifies. As it says here, and no one receives his testimony. Now that's rather odd because, the point being made here is that if you want to know something, you go to the source. So if you want to know about God, you go to the one who came from God. And he can tell you about God because he came from God. He was there with God, is essentially what is being said here. But then he says at the end of this, and no one receives his testimony. Now this is one of the reasons why I think these are the words of the Apostle John rather than John the Baptizer, because what is the discussion here? The whole introduction to this discussion is that people are flocking to Jesus to be baptized by his disciples because they are receiving his testimony and they are believing him. So if this is John the Baptizer speaking, that makes no sense. It's inconsistent with what we just read a few verses above this in the beginning of this discussion here. However, if this is the Apostle John, and he's writing in the mid to late 80s AD, about 60 years from now, it makes perfect sense because then John is looking back over this 60 years or so and realizing that most people have not accepted Jesus. So I think that is consistent with what we see from history there. And therefore, I think this is actually the words of the Apostle John, not John the Baptizer, that we're reading here in this section. And verse 33, to continue this train of thought, he who has received his testimony has certified that God is true. In other words, those who accept Jesus Christ's words, his testimony, are certifying that it is true and that it does come from God, who himself is true as well. So this is in contrast to those that we, in the previous verse, who don't accept that testimony and in doing so essentially are denying God, is the contrast that's being drawn there. And verse 34, for he whom God has sent speaks the words of God, for God does not give the Spirit by measure. Or by the wording there is kind of awkward. It's like using a measuring cup. God does not give his Spirit by a measuring cup, a limited amount, in other words. I like the way the NIV puts this, for God gives the Spirit without limit. Referring to Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ came from God, and God gave him the Holy Spirit without limit, without measure. In other words, is the point that is being made here. Verse 35, the Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand. And last time we talked a great deal about John 3:16, about how both God the Father and Jesus Christ gave up what was most valuable to them for our sakes, so that we might receive God's gift of salvation. This is the same theme that is being carried on here, which again is why I think this is John himself, his thoughts that are being expressed here. That God loved the Son so much that he has given everything into his hand, as it says here in verse 35. And you might write down Philippians 2 and verses 9 through 11. Here we talked about that quite a bit last time, read through the first part of Philippians chapter 2, which talks about how Jesus, even though he was God, he had that power, that glory, that divinity of God, that he didn't consider it something to be tightly held on to, but he emptied himself and became a servant in the form of man, in the form of a physical human being, even to the death of the cross. And this is what follows immediately after that. Because of that, because Jesus Christ sacrificed and emptied himself in that way, we read this, therefore God is also has highly exalted him and given him the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of those in heaven and of those on earth and of those under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. But the point I wanted to bring out is that God has highly exalted him. God has, this confirms what we're just reading back here, that God has given all things into his hand. God has exalted the Son above everything except the Father himself. And let's see, where are we here? John 3 and verse 36 at the bottom here. He who believes in the Son has everlasting life, and he who does not believe in the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides in him. Now, as we talked about last time with John 3:16, God is a God of great love. Quoted the two verses from John, his first epistle, that God is love. However, as we talked about last time, God is a God of judgment as well, and that is what is being talked about here. Again, a repeat of the same theme. Again, I think this is the Apostle John writing. By that I mean that ultimately every human being is going to have to make a choice. Either we will believe in Jesus as the Son of God and accept the implications of what that means in terms of how we live, or we will choose not to believe that, and we will have experienced the consequences of that lack of belief. So every human being, to get cut to the chase, every human being is either going to have to choose life, belief in Jesus Christ as the source of everlasting life, or we're going to choose death, which is refusing to accept Jesus as the Son of God and God's gift of life. So now we come to a transition point in here. Any questions on that? Yes, Arthur. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and how can you reconcile that with, you know, the whole point of John 1, the whole first chapter is, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And that shows the very one who gave that law is the one who became Jesus Christ. So why would he do away with his own law? It just makes no sense whatsoever. Yes, the Father, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, true. Yeah, good comments. Yeah, appreciate that. So now we come to a really fascinating section here that talks about Jesus leaving Judea and heading north into Galilee. And let's see what's going on here. Give you a little background. Let's first acknowledge we know that Jesus grew up in Nazareth. Where is Nazareth? Nazareth is in Galilee. It's about 15 miles roughly west of the Sea of Galilee. It's in the heart of Galilee. So Jesus has grown up there. He's familiar with Galilee. But now we're 8, 9, 10 months into his ministry, and he's been, as we just read, teaching and baptizing, or He's not baptizing, his disciples are there in Judea. And now he is changing from Judea and going up, and he's going to center his ministry, you might say, make it his base of operations, I guess would be a good way to phrase it, in Galilee. We'll talk about Galilee more next time or the time after that. But this is the transition point that we're reading about here. So let's read a little bit and see what is going on and why he makes this change at this point in his ministry. So continuing right on in John 4 in verse 1, therefore, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself did not baptize, but his disciples did the baptizing, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee, but he needed to go through Samaria. So at least three interesting things to pick up on here. First, Jesus and his disciples are having a lot of success. They're baptizing more people than John is. Crowds are coming. They're attracted to Jesus and his teaching and to be baptized. They're getting a lot of attention there. So if they're having this success, if they're attracting a lot of people coming to be baptized, why do they pack up and go about 70, 80 miles north to Galilee? Does that make sense? Just leave that question out there for you. Why did they do that? Well, as stated in verse 1 here, Jesus knows that the Pharisees are aware that he's having a lot of success and drawing a lot of attention. And if the Pharisees know, then surely other people know as well, like the authorities there in Jerusalem. Perhaps the Romans as well. We saw earlier in discussing John the Baptizer's ministry that early on, he's down baptizing in the Jordan area, not far north of the Dead Sea. And what happens? The Sadducees and the Pharisees send people out to check him out, send spies to see what he's saying, see what he's teaching, in other words, there. And anytime somebody sends spies out to spy on you, that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. And notice here, verse 4, it says that he needed to go through Samaria. He needed to. There's some compelling reason for him doing this. Now, this is a shortcut. He's going to take a shortcut through Samaria to get to Galilee. But why? Why did he need to take the shortcut through Samaria? What's going on here? Well, again, I'll leave that question hanging out there. Let's read some more. Luke 3. But Herod the Tetrarch, being rebuked by him, by John the Baptizer, concerning Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, and for all the evils which Herod Antipas, this is, had done, also added this, above all, that he shut John up in prison. John the Baptizer again. So who is this? This is not Herod the Great. Herod the Great has died about 30 years before this. This is Herod the Tetrarch. When Herod the Great died, his kingdom was divided up into four parts. And that's what Tetrarch means, a ruler of a fourth part. It was divided up among his sons for the most part. And one of these sons is Herod Antipas. We'll come across him a number of times in the Gospels. He's not identified as such, but this is who it is. Herod Antipas, A-N-T-I-P-A-S, there for your reference. Now this Herod Antipas, there's some problem here with Herodias, his brother's wife. What's happened is Herod Antipas has married his brother, actually his half-brother, but the Greek doesn't have a term for that, so he's called his brother. What Herod Antipas did is married his own half-brother's wife, which is a very adulterous situation there. And and as it says here, being rebuked by John concerning Herodias, he shut John up in prison. So what this is saying is John the Baptizer confronts Herod Antipas because he's married his own sister-in-law, and for his troubles he gets shut up in prison. And what happens to somebody who gets shut up in Herod's prison? You don't come out alive, to be blunt. Let's move on to another scripture. Matthew 4 and verse 12. Now when Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he departed to Galilee. There's a connection there. Jesus here, John, is put in prison, and he heads out for Galilee. Now let's look at a map and start putting these pieces together that we've seen from John, from Luke, from Matthew. We'll touch on Mark in just a minute here. And see. Let's look at the map. It's on the back of your harmony there, but I'll project it up here as well. And let's look at the pieces here. So John the Baptizer gets tossed into prison. The Gospels don't say where. However, Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that it was at this place called Machaerus, down here on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. Machaerus, if you've seen photos of Masada, it would be very similar to that. We've talked about the Herodium near Bethlehem, another Herod the Great did. He's paranoid, so he builds all these fortresses around his kingdom so that he's never more than a few hours away because he's paranoid. He's convinced people are going to try to kill him, overthrow him, take his kingdom from him. So he builds this series of fortresses all over his empire. Masada is one of these fortresses. Herodium is another. There's actually 7 or 8 of them. Machaerus is one that happens to be over here on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. It's on a mountaintop. I'll show you some pictures of it when we get into more detail on this in a future lesson. But it's a stronghold. It's a fortress palace, combination fortress palace there. And this is where he locks up John the Baptizer, here in Machaerus, we learn from Josephus. Now, we're not told exactly where Jesus is. We're just told that he is baptizing, or his disciples are, in Judea, in this region around here. And to orient ourselves, here's Jerusalem here. A dividing line between Judea and Samaria is roughly along in here. They're all part of one Roman province during that period. Somebody asked a question in Denver this morning, are these one and the same? Well, administratively, yes. One of Herod's sons was given this whole area when Herod's kingdom was divided up. But the son turned out to be such a wretched ruler that the Jews petitioned Rome directly to get rid of this lout. He's a miserable ruler. We don't want him. So Rome actually came in and deposed Herod's son and put a Roman governor over this area, which is how we get the Roman governor Pontius Pilate, and later Festus and Felix that we read about in the book of Acts. So this area is directly administered by Rome here. The others are still administered by, at least at this point, two of Herod's sons. One of them, Herod Antipas, governing this area in the light grayish blue, and Philip, the other one we just read about, ruling over this area up here to the north, although you can see it on your map on the back here. So that's kind of what is going on there. Now, normally a Jew, Jesus is here in Judea somewhere. Normally, if you're going to Galilee, the Jews hated the Samaritans and vice versa. We'll touch on why here in a few minutes. Normally, what you would have done is from Jerusalem, you would have taken this road down to Jericho. This is a very mountainous, rugged area right in here on this side of the mountains. So there are very few roads that go down. So you would have gone down to Jericho, headed over, crossed over the Jordan River at the ford there that we talked about, I believe, last time. And you would have gone up the east side of the Jordan River along the road till you got up and then could cross over. So you're not setting foot on Samaritan soil. That was the way it was done. If you're living in Galilee, you've got to come down for the feast or Passover in Jerusalem. You come down the east side of the Jordan River and then cross over so as to avoid the land of the Samaritans, and vice versa. If you're going from Jerusalem to Galilee, you go this way. You don't cut through Samaria for reasons we'll talk about in just a minute here. So Jesus, however, doesn't do that. He heads straight through Samaria, the shortest route to get up to Galilee. So why does he do that? Well, again, where is John imprisoned? He's imprisoned down here at Machaerus. This is probably, 12 miles maybe from the ford here, which would have been the normal way to go up to get to Galilee. Jesus probably knows that Herod Antipas is here. We'll get to the story, if you remember, how the circumstances of John's execution, which we're not to that point of the story yet, but you remember Salome is dancing, and Herod Antipas likes her dance so much, he asks, whatever you ask, I'll give. What do you want? And what does she ask? She asks for John's head on a platter, on a plate. Where does that take place? The Gospels don't tell us. But Josephus does. It took place here at Machaerus. So I think Herod is probably down here at Machaerus with John down in his dungeon right there. Jesus is somewhere over here across the Dead Sea in Judea. Hears that John has been thrown in prison. If he's going to go to Galilee, is he going to come down here within a few miles in this territory that's administered by Herod Antipas, where he has his soldiers, his police, to go up to Galilee? No. That's why he makes a beeline through Samaria to get to Galilee. Is it saying that Jesus is a coward? No, it's not. What it is saying is he knows that his time is not yet. But he sees what has happened to John. He knows, as we read just a few verses earlier, that he's drawing a lot of attention. He knows the Pharisees know that he's drawing a lot of attention. He knows the Pharisees are not his friends, and they're going to conspire with whoever it takes to cause trouble for him. So we can see things, the political situation shaping up there that is not good for him. And he knows if he stays around here, somebody's going to learn about it. Herod Antipas, the Romans, Temple Sadducees, whatever. The pressure, the opposition is building because of his success. So he says, I better move. So he moves up to Galilee. And that begins the next phase of his ministry. Now, no single one of the gospel writers puts all of this picture together. But you look at all four of them, and you compare that with what Josephus tells us, you get the picture, and you realize why Jesus left Judea, where he's having a lot of success, and transfers his base of operations up to Galilee. Because the heat is getting on down here. To be blunt, he knows that prophetically, he's going to die at a Passover because of all the symbolism there. He knows his ministry is going to last several years. He may not know exactly how long at this point. So he avoids all of these potential problems. Again, knowing his time is not yet. And he moves up to Galilee there, specifically to Capernaum. And we'll talk about why Capernaum when we talk about Galilee here in a future class. So let's read a couple of other verses down here at the bottom of page 14, Mark 1 and verse 14. Now after John was put in prison, Jesus came to Galilee. Mark is just really summarizing what we've just covered, preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God. And Luke 4 and verse 14, then Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and news of him went out through all the surrounding region. So it's interesting how each of the four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all give us slightly different pieces of the puzzle. They all emphasize what is important to them, but nobody gives us the entire picture, the whole story there. But you put them together and you get the whole story of what is going on. And it shows a couple of things. One, it shows that the gospel writers didn't get together and coordinate their stories. They all wrote independently of one another. They all included different details that the other doesn't include, as we've seen right here. So the stories differ in what details they include, but together it gives us a full picture. It makes perfect sense when we put all the pieces together. Now this also gives the lie to a lot of the Bible critics who say that none of the gospel writers wrote in the first century. They all wrote a century or two later, and they totally made everything up. They didn't live then. They didn't witness these events. It's all a fabrication. Because if that is the case, how do you get all these details that mesh together perfectly? If people are making it all up a century or two later, makes no sense. How do you get these details that mesh perfectly with what Josephus tells us about where and when John is in prison there? Which tells us why Jesus left at this point in his ministry and went up to Galilee. So again, it puts the lie to a lot of these critics' arguments there against the Bible. So hope you can understand that. So before we're a point of shifting gears, any questions about any of that I've covered here? Comments, thoughts, whatever? Otherwise, Larry, you look puzzled there. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. Right. Right.
There's two different views of that particular prophecy, the 70 weeks prophecy. Part of it is very clear. It tells us, as we covered in a previous class, the exact year that Jesus would begin his ministry, 27 AD. There is a question about the he in there, and it's a long discussion we don't have time to get into now, but for that reason I didn't come out and explicitly go through that particular aspect of it. That is a subject for a future class, but it would take probably 20-30 minutes to go through all the ins and outs of that. Could well be if that is indeed what it's referring to. Yes, Jesus would have been familiar with that and would have known how long his ministry would last, and would realize that, yeah, this is way too early for this to happen, so I need to do something, which is move out of here and move up to Galilee. So, yeah, good good comment there. Okay, let's switch gears here and continue with the story of the woman at the well. And in Samaria, this will begin in John 4 and verse 5, continuing in John's Gospel here. So he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. And let's look at a map again and orient ourselves. So Jesus has been somewhere down here in Judea. He's going through Samaria, and you can see this city of Sychar just above Samaria. Again, it's on your map on the back, but this is the location right there. I'm not sure why the map makers here put a question mark after this, because it's very definitive where this took place. For details, we'll see in just a moment here. This area is today a place that shows up in the news fairly regularly. If you watch the news from Israel, it's a place better known as Nablus. Nablus. It's been in the news not so much in the last few years, but a decade or so ago, because frankly there were a lot of Arab terrorists coming out of Nablus and performing attacks, carrying out attacks there in Israel. This is the same place, Sychar, Nablus. Sychar or Nablus. It's quiet today. It's quite a large city of about 100,000 people, overwhelmingly Arab. Before it came to be known as Sychar, its biblical name was Shechem, a place we've probably heard of, Shechem. Here's what it looked like in 1918 in an aerial photo, the town of Sychar, Arab village. It's located in the valley between two famous mountains mentioned in the Bible, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. Probably heard about those before. And you can actually see the feet of these mountains here, sloping up and beyond the city here. Again, this is 1918. It's fairly small at this point. Now it fills this entire valley to overflowing. Again, this is the area between Mounts Ebal and Gerizim. Here's a woodcut from the 1880s, I believe it is, showing the village down here. And you can actually see Mount Ebal and Gerizim coming up before in this small village here down in the valley. So this will help orient us a bit to it. There's a tremendous amount of biblical history that took place in this area. I'll just hit some of the high spots without elaborating on it, but just to help you get a feel for what all has transpired in this area. That's just this one valley that's about a mile long and maybe a half a mile wide here. So a few of the things that took place here. Abraham built an altar and was promised the land there at Shechem. See that from Genesis 12, 6 and 7. I'd recommend you just write down the scriptures, not all that happened. Jacob, or Israel, lived and built an altar there as well, Genesis 33. Simeon and Levi killed the men of Shechem after Dinah, their sister, was raped. You may remember the story. They talked the men of Shechem into being circumcised. And while they were, shall we say, recovering from that procedure, Simeon and Levi took their swords and killed them all. Pretty gory. Another incident that happened there is that Joseph came to Shechem looking for his brothers who were out tending the flocks and herds of their father. And they went to, Joseph didn't find them there at Shechem, but they were nearby at Dothan. And then they went there, and if you remember the story, they lowered Joseph down in a well and sold him to a band of traders heading through on the way to Egypt. Some other things that happened in this area. Joseph died down in Egypt, and the Israelites, when they left Egypt, took Joseph's bones because he didn't want to stay buried in Egypt. And they took him and buried them at Shechem. And you can actually go and see the tomb of Joseph to this day here at Shechem. Another thing that happened here, the Israelites, when they crossed over into the Promised Land, they went to Mount Ebal and Gerizim, these two big mountains, and half the tribe, six of the tribes, got on one side, six on the other side of this valley that we saw in the illustration a few minutes ago, and they shouted the blessings and cursings back and forth across this valley. And I was actually able to go through Shechem in 98, and it's amazing because in these mountains there are two natural amphitheaters, one on either side. And as I was going through there with Don Harms, I commented, you know, is this where the Israelites would have gathered and shouted back and forth? And sure enough, later I came across some scientists had done an acoustical study, and they had put men on one side of the valley in this natural amphitheater and some on the other, and they shouted back and forth, and they could actually hear each other very plainly, because this natural amphitheater on either side amplified their voices. So I think, yeah, this is probably exactly where this took place there. So rather interesting to see, to go and see the terrain and visualize how this probably transpired there. Another important point, Joshua, when he is nearing his death, gave his last words to Israel there at Shechem. And finally, last point to bring up here, there are others, but I'm just hitting the high spots. Shechem became the first capital of Jeroboam after Solomon died and his kingdom split, and the 10 northern tribes went after Jeroboam. Shechem was actually his first capital. As a matter of fact, this is where the split took place here with Rehoboam, if you remember the story. So let's look at that on a map. Here's the map we've been looking at, and to show you the 10 tribes. Yeah, this is the large green area that became the northern 10 tribes, and Judah with the two tribes and most of Levi down in the south. And again, here's Shechem. And after, under King Omri, don't remember where he was in the order of kings, but he built a new capital for the 10 tribes called Samaria. And this is where the land got its name, Samaria. This is about 900 years before what we're reading here in the first century. So Samaria became the capital of Israel. You'll see Israel referred to as Samaria there in the book of 1 and 2 Kings, and this is why. And again, this is only about 8 or 10 miles from Shechem, so the capital wasn't all that far from it there. So there was a great deal of hostility. I mentioned I'd talk about this, all the hostility between the Jews and the Samaritans in Jesus' time. As I mentioned, the Jews would not go through Samaria for the most part here, because sometimes the Samaritans would attack Jews and kill them. There are actually historical records that talk about this there in the first century. It wasn't one-sided either, because the Jews, if they caught a Samaritan on Jewish territory, they sometimes attacked and killed them as well. So there's no love lost between these two groups of people. In fact, this city name of Sychar that we've been talking about here comes from a Hebrew word meaning drunkard. So drunkard. So apparently the Jews have renamed Shechem after the Samaritans blew there. They called it Drunkville there, Winoville, whatever you want to call it there, because it is a deliberate insult to the people there. This is just one more indicator of the kind of hostility and animosity between these two groups of people. So where did this hostility come from? We'll come across this a number of times in the gospel, so want to help us understand what this is rooted in and give a short history lesson. It may be review to some of you, may be new to others here. But again, after King Solomon died, his kingdom is divided into the 10 northern tribes, forming the kingdom of Israel here, and then the two tribes forming the kingdom of Judah in the south, along with a lot of the Levites. You can read about this in 1 Kings 12. And Solomon had already led the kingdom of Israel into a lot of idolatry because of his 1,000 wives and concubines that he has there. So Jeroboam becomes the king, and he takes it even worse. There's never a good king in the history of Israel. They're all following in the sins and the idolatry of Jeroboam there. Jeroboam also set up 2 idolatrous centers, Bethel, down here just north of the border. He's trying to attract the people who used to go down to Jerusalem for the feasts. So he sets a new worship center here near the border to capture people, to keep them from going all the way to Jerusalem. And he sets up another one up here in Dan, which is off the map to the north there. And these two kingdoms did not have a peaceful history. At various times, they're fighting against each other, actually warring against each other, and that did not help the relations either. Eventually, to make a long story short, God got fed up with Israel's rebellion, their idolatry, their Sabbath breaking, and he allows the Assyrians to invade and take the northern 10 tribes captive. Some of the Israelites fled. As the Assyrians came down from the north, they fled down to the south. And archaeologically, Jerusalem actually expands roughly 3 to 4 times its size at the period that the Assyrian invasions. It's because of all these refugees coming down from Israel in the north. And that's why we find some of the 10 tribes intermixed to this day with those of Judah, of Benjamin and Levi, Benjamin and Judah, and some of Levi mixed in. So that's what's going on. We know that archaeologically. A few of the poorer people of the land, the homeless, the people, the tenant farmers, people who don't have anything, are left there. But for the most part, Israel is wiped out and moved away, taken captive into Babylon. We'll read about this very, very quickly here, 2 Kings 17, beginning in verse 5. Read about this invasion and fall. Now, the king of Assyria went throughout all the land, and went up to Samaria, the city, the capital city, and besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the last king of Israel, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Halah and by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and the cities of the Medes. This is modern-day Iraq and Iran. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Eternal, their God, and they had feared other gods. And skipping through a lot of the details down to verse 22. Let's try this again. Come on here. This laptop's had a rough day so far. All right, what's going on? It has frozen up on me here. Well, you have to understand, this is a Microsoft product I'm using here, so. Okay. Yeah. All right, I'm going to have to quit this briefly here and come back. Let me know where I am. Oh, boy, this is really not wanting to do this. Okay. I'll go ahead and read the rest of this passage here while this is rebooting. Verse 22 of 2 Kings 17. For the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, first king of Israel, which he did. They did not depart from them until the Eternal removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon. So what this is describing is the people of Israel are taken away by the Assyrians far over into what is today modern-day Iraq and Iran. And then verse 24, then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria in place or instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in his cities. So what it's saying is the Assyrians took the Israelites, lock, stock, and barrel, moved them away, 1,000 miles away, and took the people from there and moved them over and plopped them down in the Israelite cities. Now, why did the Assyrians do that? Well, the Assyrians were a very bloodthirsty people. You don't mess with a boss is the point they're trying to make here. So what they would do is they would uproot people from their lands and take them away from their cities, from their towns, from their houses, from their vineyards, from their wells, from their fields, from their orchards, move them away where they have nothing to fight for. Move them away from their own gods, even. Move them to a foreign land where they're strangers. And it removes the incentive to rebel at that point because they have nothing to fight for there anymore. To be blunt, that's what is going on here. So the Assyrians dealt with rebellion very, very harshly. And as we see from this example, and we know this not just from the Bible, but from Assyrian records as well. They're very proud of the way that they dealt with people in that. I have a couple of carvings I want to show you here next where archaeologists have actually excavated some of the throne rooms of the Assyrian kings that are mentioned in the Bible, and they show exactly what we're talking about here. So that's what we'll look at when I bring this back up here. So any questions or well, let's see, let me bring up another question. Somebody mentioned this. Take another couple of minutes for this to bring up, so I'll discuss this. The peoples coming from Babylon and these other areas brought their own religions with them as well, their own gods. So what they do is they come, they settle in to Galilee, into the area of Samaria, and they start mixing their own religions with a little bit of the true religion there. Also in the same chapter we've been talking about, 2 Kings 17, the part I skipped over, talks about how the wild animals start attacking these new people who have moved into this area because the population's been moved out. So the lions are attacking the people there, and the Babylonians plead with the Assyrians, give us somebody who knows the ways of the God of this land, because they believe gods were limited to specific geographical areas, you know, a specific valley, a specific mountain, or so on. So they said, bring somebody in who knows about the God of this land and can take care of these lions who are attacking us here. So they bring in one of the priests of Samaria, bring him back, plop him down there in Samaria, and he essentially starts this new religion that's a mixture of some of the truth out of the Bible and a lot of paganism from these people who've been brought over from Babylon. And this is the roots, the origins of this mixture called syncretism, of mixing different religious practices and belief systems together. And this is one of the reasons why the Jews really despise the Samaritans, because they've mixed the truth of God with error. And God despises it as well. So it's really no different than what we see in Christianity today. What has Christianity today done? It's taken these mixtures of paganism, pagan belief, practices, rituals, and so on. It's mixed it with elements of the truth of God to come up with this hybrid mixture there. Another thing the Samaritans did, I'm continuing on, getting ahead of myself while I wait for this to catch up, but their Bible was what is called a Samaritan Pentateuch. You might have heard that term before. Pentateuch is the five books of Moses: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That was all the Bible they accepted. They threw out the rest of it, throughout the prophets, throughout the Psalms, throughout the Proverbs, throughout 1 and 2 Kings, Chronicles, Samuel, and so on, throughout the minor prophets, throughout all of that except for the five books of Moses. And that, they rewrote portions of it. One thing they did, for instance, in the Samaritan Pentateuch, well, from Genesis we know that Abraham went to sacrifice his son Isaac, was prevented from doing so, but where did that happen? It took place at Mount Moriah, which is today the Temple Mount. Well, in Samaritan Pentateuch, that didn't take place at Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. It took place on Mount Gerizim, there in Samaria. So they rewrote portions of the Bible to make Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the events of their lives took place in Samaria, not down in Judea. Now, some of that did take place there, but they did this to rewrite their Bible to make it fit with their interpretation. We'll see that in a few minutes when we get to what the woman at the well says to Jesus. how she's rewriting history there, making the Samaritans the true descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob rather than the Jews there. So this is part of what is going on, and this is yet another reason why the Jews despise the Samaritans, because they've taken the Bible, thrown most of it out, and rewrote part of it as well. And this, too, is another thing that modern Christianity does as well. What does it do? It throws out the entirety of the Old Testament. It says it doesn't matter. It's not valid anymore. So they throw out three quarters of the Bible. So there's really not a whole lot of differences between what the ancient Samaritans are doing and what Christianity today is doing. Yes, Arthur. Yeah. Right. Yeah. They would consider that blasphemy of the worst sort there, too. Yeah, Larry. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, good. Somebody just studied up on their history. Yeah, but I was actually going to get to that. But yeah. Yeah, the exact dates the Samaritans built their own version of the temple on Mount Gerizim in 388 B.C., and I think it was 188 B.C., John Hyrcanus took an army up to Samaria, destroyed that temple. That would be the equivalent of somebody coming in destroying the Jews' temple. So no, they did not take that well. So this is another source of this hatred and friction between these two people. Just absolutely detested each other. So yeah, it's just a history that goes back for centuries there. Of one thing after another. Another one I'll go ahead and hit as we're getting close here. Nehemiah, if you remember the story, when he comes back and he's rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and the temple, that there's a lot of opposition from the people of the land. One of the main people in opposition to Nehemiah is a fellow by the name of Sanballat. Who is Sanballat? He's the governor of Samaria. Of the city and that region. He's one of the big people trying to work behind the scenes to undermine and oppose Nehemiah in every way he can to keep the Jews from rebuilding Jerusalem and the temple there. So there's just one thing after another of conflict for these people going back almost 1,000 years there, this hostility between the two people. Yes, Arthur. Oh, really? Huh. Uh-huh. Huh. Interesting. Yeah, wasn't aware of that. I think there's probably a half dozen or so places where John the Baptist's head is enshrined somewhere in this or that church. I just read about a new one in the last 2 weeks at some place that supposedly has his head. That it was a new one on me. But yeah, I hadn't heard of the mosque in Damascus. So yeah, now we're almost back up here. So let's get back. Show you some of the Assyrian carvings from the throne rooms of the Assyrian kings. This is not drawn to scale or carved to scale. This is carved out of stone. But to orient you as to what is happening here, you see a hill and you see this fortress on top of it. This would have been like Samaria. You can see the turrets, the towers there up on top, and you see some of the defenders of the city, again, not drawn to scale. But over here you see the Assyrian soldiers leaning ladders up against the walls and attacking it with shields and spears. You see one of the defenders here has got an arrow or spear in him, and he's falling off the wall. Over here you see a battering ram with two beams coming out. They would have had big iron points on them to smash into the wall and break up the stones. And it's mounted on wheels going up the siege ramp that they would build. And on the top of it, this thing, it looks like a big blanket, is a coating of leather to protect the soldiers inside from people throwing boulders and arrows and boiling oil and fire, firebrands, this kind of thing on there as well. And then over here are some of the Assyrian archers that are laying down cover fire by firing arrows. So this is from a throne room of one of the Assyrian kings there, and it's showing exactly the siege tactics that are used and the equipment and the weaponry and all of this. I see we don't have many of our children, so I'll go ahead and point out some of the grosser things in here, which I didn't in Denver, but down here is an Assyrian soldier beheading a captive. And you can see this corpse here without a head on it. Beside it here you see several captives who've been impaled on wooden beams stuck up in the ground. So this is the reality of what the Assyrians did, and they glorified this type of gore. And then another illustration shows the aftermath of this battle, and these are the refugees, like we talked about, being taken away to other parts of the Assyrian Empire. And you can see a donkey here with a couple of children sitting on it. You can see men walking, carrying burdens on their heads. Here's a man with his little child riding piggyback on his shoulders, and they've got a 1,000-mile walk ahead of them to these periods of exile. Here's some of the women carrying their burdens as well. So the Assyrians glorified, recorded all their exploits in this type of thing. So not long after Samaria fell, a similar pattern happened with the Jews in Babylon and Jerusalem, except at the hand of the Babylonians. They came through and took them into captivity. The big difference is the Jews who were taken into captivity in Babylon, it actually strengthened their religious beliefs and faith and practice, whereas the Israelites were taken away and they lost their identity and disappeared from history. The Jews realized, they knew from the prophets that they were being taken into captivity because of two things primarily: idolatry, worship of other gods, and Sabbath breaking. So that set the stage for the conflicts we see in the Gospels between Jesus and a lot of the religious leaders, because in Babylon, that's where the Pharisee movement started back then. And they built a wall, essentially, around the Sabbath and came up with all these nitpicky rules and regulations so that they would never break the Sabbath. You couldn't even come close to breaking the Sabbath there. So this is where a lot of that religious belief and practice and strict interpretation, well, human regulation starts, is because of the Jews being taken captive into Babylon there. And another illustration to catch us up here, this is a depiction of Nehemiah rebuilding the walls and the opposition that came from there. So, let's see, I've actually gotten ahead of my notes, so we'll pick up the story here. Any questions before I pick back up at this point? Yes, Greg. Mm-hmm. Good point. Yeah, and as a result, again, yeah, they lost their identity. They lost their connection with God to this day, to be blunt. Whereas the Jews kept that connection and consequently have kept their identity even to this day. Yes, let's see, there was another hand. Yes, Arthur? Yeah. Yeah, definitely. If you're ever in London, have a week to spare, go to the British Museum. That's what it takes me. I say that in jest, but if you have a day or two to spare, go there. You can see these carvings. And there's one Sennacherib's throne room that is just fabulous. It's a room not quite as big as this, but it shows this whole story that's laid out on the walls all the way around the room. And these carvings are maybe 3-4 feet high, and it tells a story as though you're looking at a movie of what happened. And it's the siege of Lachish, which is the last... this is during the reign of Hezekiah, and Lachish was the last major Judean fortress that fell to the Assyrians before Sennacherib came and surrounded Jerusalem. And if you remember the story, Sennacherib, they've actually found his records of that campaign, and he describes shutting up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage in Jerusalem, which is exactly what the Bible says. The Assyrians surrounded Jerusalem and trapped Hezekiah in there. But what Sennacherib doesn't say is what happened next that we know from the Bible. That an angel came down, slew all of Sennacherib's army. He went back to Assyria with his tail between his legs. And 2 years later, his sons assassinate him. But they have excavated Sennacherib's throne room where he shows the siege and fall of Lachish there. And it's an amazing story to see, but it's only one. There's actually probably 3 or 4 different Assyrian throne rooms of these different emperors that depict stories like these that I've shown you up here. And it's just amazing stuff, just so real, so lifelike there. It's like looking at a movie from 2,700 years ago. Just amazing, amazing stuff. So if you're ever there, go to the Assyrian section of the British Museum. Your time. Okay. Accidentally. Yeah. Okay. There we go. So yeah, a lot of other good stuff too. A lot of Babylonian, Egyptian antiquities, Greek. It's just a fabulous archaeological collection here at the British Museum. There's actually a great book that I have called The Bible in the British Museum, and it shows probably 100 or more different artifacts that have been excavated that are in the British Museum that tie in directly with biblical history in different ways. So, amazing stuff. One of my favorite places in the world. So, back to our story here. I'm going to rip through this pretty quickly here. Verse 5 of John 4. So he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the 6th hour. A few things to note here again, tremendous amount of biblical history in this area. The towns at that time had a community well that looked something like this. This is a modern reproduction of one. Wells were very tough to dig. It's limestone there. So you have to carve one out. Generally, only the very wealthy people could afford their own private well. Everybody else went to a community well. It was a community water source. And it would be covered with stone there, surrounded by stone to keep it from eroding and filling in. It would also have water troughs like these, where the shepherds could come and water their sheep and their goats there if there wasn't a nearby stream or something for them to use. So this would have been the kind of setting that we're reading about here, this community well. Now this takes place... the women would come there generally twice a day, in the morning and in the evening. And they would bring large pottery jugs that would carry probably 3 to 5 gallons of water, which is pretty heavy. And they would take the water back to their houses, and they would use it there for washing their food, for cooking, for whatever personal hygiene needs, washing they would do, that sort of thing, for bathing. And again, drawing the water was considered women's work there. They would do it twice a day, morning and evening. What's unusual is this happens at the 6th hour. They counted the days then from 6 a.m., sunrise, basically. So this is taking place at noon. Women didn't come to draw their water and haul it home in the middle of the day, in the heat of the day. They'd come in the morning or evening when it's cooler here. Incidentally, you can go and visit Jacob's well today. It's under a church today, but Don Harms and I were able to visit it back in 1998 on a feast trip there. And I even drank some of the water inside it, which I got diarrhea from that, and that's another story we won't talk about today. But one of the hazards you do for science and archaeology. But continuing to the story here, verse 7, a woman of Samaria comes at the 6th hour to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. So notice a couple of things here. Again, rip through these quickly. Jesus is tired from his journey. He's wearied, as we see here, having been walking in the heat of the day. He's thirsty as he asks the woman for a drink of water. He's probably hungry, too, because the disciples have gone in to buy bread. So what does this tell us? It tells us he's human. He's not totally divine. He's not totally human. He's human and divine. He has the same weaknesses as we do. He gets tired. He gets hot. He gets thirsty. He gets hungry. However, later we see he performs miracles to feed thousands of people, multiplying bread and fish. But he doesn't use his miraculous power to satisfy his own needs. He only does that for other people. So just something to think about there. Another interesting point is the disciples have gone into the city to buy food. Now, the enmity between the Jews and the Samaritans was so great that the Jews would not eat food that had been touched or prepared by a Samaritan. There was actually a saying I came across that it would be better to eat swine's flesh than to eat food of a Samaritan, because they considered it unclean, because they despised the Samaritans. So it's better to eat unclean food than something that's been touched by a Samaritan. So what's with the disciples going into a Samaritan town to buy food? Well, again, this is 8, 9, 10 months into Christ's ministry, and obviously what has happened is some of those old prejudices Jesus is teaching is starting to sink in to his disciples. And they're getting over some of their old prejudices there that they would have had. It's not stated, but again, culturally, we know that that would be the case. So this woman comes in the heat of the day, the sixth hour. And why does she do that? Well, let's read on a little further. Verse 9, then the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Several things to notice here. First of all, he's doing a typical rabbi thing, as we've talked about before. He gives a puzzling statement, puzzling question. We saw this with Nicodemus last time. To get people to think, to challenge them. The rabbis wouldn't come right out and say everything. No, they want you to think. They want you to come to your own conclusion. And you do that by asking questions, giving challenging statements to make them think about it and come to the conclusion themselves. Jesus wants him to work, or her, in this case, to work toward the conclusion. He's going to guide her in this process by giving her these puzzling statements here. Same thing that happened to Nicodemus. You parallel those two and you see the same exact teaching technique being used there. So Jesus also uses a term here that's easy to gloss over if we don't understand. He said he could give living water. Now, what's he talking about with living water? What is living water? Israel's a pretty dry area. Gets about 20, 25 inches of moisture a year. About half again what we get here. This is a photo from the top of Mount Gerizim right here, and looking across the valley to Mount Ebal to the north, and you can see the city of Nablus down filling up this valley in between. So you can see it's pretty dry there, drier about the way it is here overall. So rain, it doesn't rain in Israel from about May to November, about 6 months, just doesn't rain. They have the rainy season in between. Rain start about November on up through the spring harvests of wheat and barley, celebrated in Pentecost and the Days of Unleavened Bread. So people of that day, to have a water source during the 6 months when it doesn't rain, they constructed cisterns, which is a small cavity underground carved out of the limestone, would be plastered with waterproof plaster there. And that would get you through, you'd store the water during the rainy season, and that would give you a source of water during the dry 6 months of the year. And so that was pretty common. The other source of water, when Jesus refers to living water here, that is water that is not from a cistern, but water that is from a spring, from a stream, from a river, like the Jordan River, or from a well, well water was living water because it was water that was moving. Moving water, living water, as they viewed it. It's fresh. It's cool. It's refreshing. It's life-giving. It's energizing. That's why it's called living water. The other source of water, again, was cisterns. Here's a cistern. This is Don Harms, he and I, in the town of Shiloh, where the tabernacle was kept there for several centuries there. This is an underground system carved out of limestone. And what they would do is they would dig ditches or carve channels during the rainy season. The water would come, run into the ditches, and it would channel, run downhill to fill up a cistern like this, underground storage chamber, carved out of stone. And it would run in through holes like these and fill up the cistern. This is actually filled up the original floor. This is probably 10 or 12 feet below this. So this is how much debris and rock and mud have washed into this cistern over the last 3,000 years or so since this was used. So cistern water was a necessity, but it would have mud in it. It would have twigs and leaves and insects and the occasional mouse that comes in to get a drink and falls in and drowns, and rabbits and snakes and things like that. It would have algae growing in it, bacteria, things like that. So cistern water was necessary to keep alive, but it was not living water. Living water was the good stuff. That was the flowing water, the cool, refreshing water there. So when Jesus tells the woman that he can give her living water, he's doing a remez. He's doing a remez back to Jeremiah 2 and verse 13, where God says, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters," same term Jesus uses here, "and hewn themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water." What he's doing here is contrasting the living water that comes from knowing and obeying God and the refreshment and the life that comes from the living waters with the water from the cisterns that's muddy and has dead bugs in it and twigs and dead mice and stuff like that, which is representative of the way of man apart from God. That's what is being described and contrasted here. So Jesus tells this woman, "I can give you living waters," a remez, a look back, a hint, a clue back to this prophecy back here. So essentially, what's he saying? He's saying that he is God. He's the source of the living waters here. The true fountain of living, refreshing, life-giving waters. But the woman doesn't catch that. She doesn't pick up on that. So continuing on, verse 11, "The woman said to him, 'Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get this living water that you're talking about? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well?'" She's rewriting history, according to the Samaritan version, "and drank from it himself as well as his sons and his livestock." So this is another source of contention here, that the Samaritans would rewrite history to suit their own ends. But Jesus doesn't respond to her statement. Instead, he says, "Whoever drinks of this water out of this well will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." And here again, he gives a remez back to Jeremiah 2:13. Notice he says a fountain of water. And Jeremiah said, "They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters." So again, he's pointing her back to him as the Messiah, the source of living waters here. And of course, the point of Jesus' words is that through God's Spirit, we should be a source of living water to other people. We should be giving life. We should be a source of refreshing and life and comfort and nourishment to other people here, those around us. So continuing on, I'm going through this as quickly as I can here. Verse 15, "The woman said to him, 'Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw.'" They have to come and draw water out as well and haul it back to my house several times a day. Now, one thing we don't catch in reading through the Gospels is the tone of voice that is given here. Was she serious? here. I frankly kind of doubt it because of what transpires next. I think her response may have had a little bit of sarcasm in it. Something like, yes, mister, give me some of this water that you're talking about so I'll never be thirsty again, and so I don't have to haul these 30-pound jugs of water back and forth to my house several times a day. So yeah, do this. Give me some of this living water. And I think that because of what happens next, because Jesus has been kind of toying with her, you might say, by giving her these odd statements. But now he does something that absolutely stuns her in what he says next. Something that just grabs her by the throat and forces her to get serious. Notice verse 16. Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." And the woman answered and said, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You have well said, I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In this you spoke truly." Excuse me. Boy, this computer is not cooperating today. Yeah, okay, sorry about that delay. For you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly. And this woman is just dumbfounded, because how could this stranger that she's just met a few minutes before know that she's been married five times before? And that she's living with somebody who's not her husband now. Now, what does this tell us about this woman? It's one of the questions I sent out last night for us to think about. What does it tell us about the woman? Think before you answer. Does it tell us that we would assume from this that she's an immoral person? Been married five times, married and divorced five times. She's jumping from man to man, from bed to bed, looking for something better or something different, and she lacks the character to stick it out in marriage as she should. And now she's shacked up with some other guy that she's not married to. And she's coming to the well in the middle of the day, not with the women at the beginning of the day or the end of the day, but coming in the middle of the day when she knows no other woman is going to be there. Because if she came and all the other women did, she would know that, knowing women, she would be the topic of conversation. To be blunt, gossiping about her there, and she doesn't want to do that. So she comes at a time when nobody else is there. Yes, Tina. Yeah, good point. I hope all of you heard that because that's why I said think carefully before you answer, because there's another side of the story, and that is the reality of the culture of that day. Because men could divorce their women for very trivial reasons. If a woman could not bear children, if a woman could not bear him a son, if he didn't like his wife's cooking, if he wanted to trade her in on a younger, better-looking model, he could do that. He was allowed to under the laws of that day. Doesn't mean it's right. That's not something that God sanctioned or Jesus Christ did, but it was the reality of that day that women could divorce, men could divorce their wives for pretty trivial reasons. And we know this from Jewish writings of that day. And if that happened, what were the woman's options? Slim and none. If she were young enough, she might be able to go back to her family. If her parents are still alive, if her other siblings would accept that, she might be able to do that. She might try to find another husband, if she could, which might or might not work out. If she's thrown out of the house by her husband, she could resort to a life of begging, You see a lot of beggars in the Gospels showing this was common. She could turn to a life of prostitution, which we also see in the Gospels. That was the reality of the culture of that day there. Or she could find a man, move in with him. At least she'd get food. At least she'd have a roof over her head. Submitting to become essentially somebody's personal slave. That was the reality of the culture of that day. So is this woman immoral? Or is it just a matter of a woman who has had a rough life? She's at the end of her rope. Life has been very hard on her. She has no other options other than to live with this guy who's going to treat her like a slave. Something to think about. The scriptures don't say, but there's two sides of the coin there. When we understand the culture of the day, we tend to look and judge this woman very harshly. Jesus doesn't do that, though. And I think based on her reaction, it's probably the latter version that I described here. I'll talk about that a little bit more as we go on. So what happens next? Verse 19, the woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." And again, she's just been told things by a total stranger that he could not possibly have known about her. And then she says something really puzzling. "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." Now, where does this come from? Totally out of the blue. Is she changing the subject? Some commentators think that. I think, again, we need to look at the culture. What's going on here? Here's my take on this, what I think prompts this comment. She's just met a man that she says is a prophet of God. And this prophet of God has told her that either A, she's a very immoral person and needs to change her lifestyle, or B, she's somebody who very desperately needs God and to have a right relationship with her. So if you're told one or the other of those things, either way, you need to have some immediate contact with God and get things straight with Him. But how did you get right with God in that day? You went to the temple where your God lived and you offered a sacrifice. Where was her temple? It's on Mount Gerizim, right up there behind them. They can look up there and see it. But she's just had a man who's a prophet of God that she knows is a Jew. And this man of God says the place to worship is down here in Jerusalem. So the dilemma she's faced with is, which temple do I go to? I think that is what prompts this comment about the temple. And it does flow in the conversation and the logic that's taking place here. So she wants to know, which temple do I go to get right with God? The one on Mount Gerizim here behind us, or do I go down to Jerusalem, where you Jews say is where God is to worship? And then I think, too, what does Jesus say? I think this fits in with it. Jesus responds, verse 21, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain, Gerizim, behind them, nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." So what's he saying there? So he explains that it's not a matter of worshiping at a physical temple, Gerizim or Jerusalem, on a particular spot, because that's going to change. But Jesus says, essentially, however, since you brought it up, you worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. The Samaritans, in other words, got it wrong in their religion. It's a paganized hybrid there, which God doesn't accept. The Jews aren't perfect, but they're a whole lot closer to the truth than you Samaritans are. And salvation is of the Jews, because Jesus himself was a Jew. So continuing on, verse 23, "But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." Here. So again, God doesn't accept this hybrid mixture of paganism and the truth here. So we're supposed to worship God in spirit and truth, not in these half-truths or not in lies mixed with truth. So how do we worship God in spirit and truth? I'm just going to go through a few scriptures here very quickly. You may just want to write them down. Psalm 51 and verse 17. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. Romans 12, 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Conform to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And also Hebrews 13, verse 6, but do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. And finally, the words of Christ himself, Mark 12 and verse 33, and to love him, referring to the Father, with all the heart and with all the understanding, with all the soul and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as himself is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. So these verses, and there are others we could add, that talk about how to worship God in spirit and in truth there. So just in summary, a few quick points. We worship God in spirit and truth by having a humble and converted spirit, by having our minds transformed to become like Jesus Christ, by sacrificing our lives in service to God and others, and by loving God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving others as we do ourselves. And this is the worship that God is looking for from his people, not the blood of sacrifices, not the blood of bulls and goats. So continuing John 4, I am starting to get close to a conclusion here. So, verse 25, the woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. So this is quite interesting, because as near as we can tell, this is the first time that Jesus openly tells somebody that he is the Messiah. And who does he tell? He tells a Gentile and a woman. At that, doubly surprising there, because again, women were not very highly considered in that culture, in that society. Verse 27. At this point, his disciples came, and they marveled that he talked with a woman. And yet no one of the disciples said, what do you seek, or why are you talking with her? Several things. Again, it's surprising to the disciples that Jesus is talking to a woman. How were women regarded in that day? A few tidbits from history. Legally, a woman's testimony was not considered equal to that of a man, or as good as a man's, for that matter. As we talked about earlier, men could divorce their wives for any number of fairly trivial reasons there. A common prayer that is recorded from that time for a Jewish man was, I thank you, God, that I was not born a Gentile or a woman. It's the way it was there. Some of the rabbis at that time debated, had big long debates, arguments over whether women had a soul, whether they're fully human and could be a part of the kingdom of God. So women are not regarded well at that point. I'm not sure if I want to call on Marcia or not here. But I'll let you. Yeah, well, I'll stop there just for Marcia. But no, that is the reality of the culture that day. Again, it's not right. It's not coming from God. It's not coming from the Bible, not coming from Scripture, but coming from the human prejudices. And boy, if you want examples of that, look at the Muslim world today, the way women are treated. They're property. They like their sheep and their goats better than their wives. They treat them better. It's just hideous. But that kind of gives us some insight on the way women were viewed at that time. Again, that's not Christ's way. He's very different in how he treats women. As we see from this example, and as we see throughout his ministry, he elevates women to a much higher position than is normal at that time. He has women who are following him around, along with his other disciples, the men. He has close women followers who are supporting his ministry with their money, with their finances. there. His attitude is very different toward women, and he holds them in a much more elevated position there than was normal. As we see, his disciples are surprised. Well, another point I wanted to bring out here is some of the rabbis at that time taught that you couldn't speak to a woman in public, as Jesus is doing here. Even if it's your own wife or your own sister, you don't speak to a woman in public because that's a disgrace. That's a shameful thing. But here is Jesus out here, you know, right out in the open, talking with a woman here. So, again, Jesus is changing the paradigms of his disciples there. Notice, too, that they're puzzled by this, but they don't interrupt. They just stand back and watch as he's carrying on this conversation here. And when Jesus is done, then the story breaks in, continuing here in verse 27. The woman then left her water pot, went her way into the city, and said to the men of the city, "Come, see a man who told me all the things that I ever did. Could this be the Christ, the Messiah?" Then they went out of the city and came to him. Interesting little detail that she's so excited by what she's seen that she leaves her water pot and runs into the town to tell everybody about it, which means she's either in a hurry or that she's coming back again to hear more from Jesus. Either way, you interpret that, she's had a very life-changing experience there with this puzzling teacher who tells her everything she ever did there. In the meantime, his disciples urged him, saying, "Rabbi, eat." But he said to them, "I have food to eat of which you do not know." Again, he's doing the rabbi thing, giving them this challenging statement there that makes no sense to them. Therefore, verse 33, the disciples said to one another, "Has anyone brought him anything to eat while we were gone to buy food down there in the city?" And Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." In other words, Jesus says this is his mission. This is his purpose in life. This is his goal, to do the work of the Father and to finish his work, to do the will of the Father and to finish his work, in other words. And he says, "Do you not say there are still 4 months, and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest." And continuing, "And he who reaps receives wages and gathers fruit for eternal life, that both he who sows and he who reaps may rejoice together. For in this the saying is true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you have not labored. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labors." And this is kind of the story of the church through the ages, that we are here today because other people have gone before and have sowed the seed that bore fruit and took root in our lives, and we responded to that calling. And now because of our labors, our work, and our efforts, others are going to be called there in the future, just the same as we are. So that's essentially the point that is being made there. And then verse 39, to wrap this up, "And many of the Samaritans of that city believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified, 'He told me all that I ever did.' So when the Samaritans had come to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. Now this is interesting because a question we may have is, did Jesus have everything planned out? Did he know exactly how everything is going to play out in his life? This tells me right here, no, he didn't. Circumstances compel him to take a shortcut through Samaria. He stops and by chance meets this woman at the well, has a conversation with her. He's in a hurry to get to Galilee, and yet by circumstances he ends up staying there for 2 days with these people. So did Jesus have all this planned out? Obviously not. He didn't know everything that was going to happen, in other words, is a lesson we can draw from that. So, rather interesting. And to wrap up, last two verses, "And many more believed because of his own word. Then they said to the woman, 'Now we believe, not because of what you said, for we ourselves have heard him, and we know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world.'" So that wraps it up for today. Quick questions, or any quick questions, otherwise feel free to come up and check later. Yes, Mark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
True. Good observation. Yeah, probably going back to what God told Eve right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there will be a prophet like me coming along. So yeah, there are prophetic prophecies there in the Pentateuch that they would have understood, and of course they know from their whatever interaction they had with the Jews. The Jews, the messianic fever is hot and heavy at that time too. So right, good point. Yeah, yeah, it prophesies, that carries the message of the gospel, and prophesies. The prophet, yeah. Yeah, true. Yeah, we do see that. Yeah, good points. Okay, we'll wrap up there then with a closing hymn, and see all of you afterwards.